energy gives that birth. And you can also say that the kama and krodha cause the rajas also in the mind. It's very interesting. If your mind, let me just talk just about this for a minute. When your mind is at peace, means all is well with me, there's no desire that has risen in the mind. See, at that time the mind really is predominantly sattva. What sattva means, and the mind is predominantly sattva, a sattva, rajas, and tamas. It means that like a clear mirror, it simply reflects what is there. And to say for now, if some sort of desire or agitation or anger has not come into the mind, what it is that you're experiencing this life, whatever you're perceiving, as though being reflected in a calm pool or a clear mirror. There's nothing disturbed, there's no disturbance in the perception. There's no disturbance in the thinking. There's no disturbance in the feeling. It's just all taking place as though in a clear mirror. That's sattva. But when kama comes in, the clear mirror disappears, right? Because all of a sudden, in this vision that you're having through your sense perception, something stands out which I now want. This is dropping the petal in the pond. There's something that I want, right? And that wanting it makes me now, instead of there being kind of this amorphous energy, this spread out being, there's now directed energy. So we say this is the rajas is born. And Shankara takes it both ways. That kama itself is born of rajas, because that's of the sattva, rajas, and tamas. If we look at it like this, maya itself is sattva, rajas, and tamas, these three strands. And so what is it of the sattva, rajas, and tamas? What would the kama be? The rajas. Okay. What is responsible in the sattva, rajas, and tamas of maya? What is responsible for kama? So you would say rajas. But that's looking at it from like the material cause of this kama, of this energy. But then if you look at it another way, from the standpoint of the desire itself, we'd say that the desire gives birth to rajas. And now when we say like that, we're looking more at it as a quality of mind. You'll see when we get through go all the way through the Gita, like when we get to chapter 14, especially chapter 14 and 16, way. Several years from now. They talk about.
We'll be all
right. Right. They talk about sattva, rajas, and tamas as being, they look viewed as qualities of the mind. Like, for instance, we would say the person's very sattvic. You've probably heard this. It's a very sattvic person. You know, that's a very sattvic lifestyle. What does that mean? It means that there's it's contemplative. The mind is quiet and peaceful. The mind enjoys a natural shanti. The person enjoys a natural shanti. You're in a beautiful environment up in the mountains, or you know, and you say, oh, this is so peaceful, this is really a sattvic environment. Heard that, right? It means it's peaceful and it brings about absorption and contemplation in the mind. So you feel studious and meditative. It's a sattvic environment. You should eat sattvic food. Why should you eat sattvic food? So that you have that sattvic state of being. So it's sattva, rajas, and tamas is used, looked at as a quality of the mind. It's used like that. And what if we say, this person is so rajasic. Now, if usually when you say that, you mean, you usually mean the person is bad-tempered. You know, and with a lot of quick temper, restless, agitated. You know, that can be often used, the person's very rajasic, can be used negatively, like hot-tempered, angry, impatient, you know, quick to anger, this type of thing for Rajasic. Or sometimes it'll be used just neutrally. This person has so much energy, it's unbelievable. But see, well, you can have so much energy and still be sattvic. And so that's why often when you're using Rajasic, you're using it in terms of agitation. Like the still water bucket and the water bucket story, still water is sattva. Very, very sattvic. Reflects the sun beautifully. That's sattvic. The agitated water is rajasic. What happens in the agitated water, it's just very upsetting. Or you can't focus on anything. Quick to anger, that type of thing. That's rajasic. Tamas is dull. If we're using tamas as an attribute of the mind, then it's dull, slow, sleepy, tired, you know. These are the dull-witted, asuric. That's how tamas is often used, as these qualities. And so now Shankara uses it in both ways. Right? The kama itself, because it's an energy, you know, it goes after sattva, it's born of rajas. Or you can say the desire itself is rajasic because it creates agitation. Right? It divides the world up. It creates agitation. You have to go after something. You have to protect yourself. You have to get rid of your enemies and bring on your friends in order to help you achieve that desire. And once you achieve the desire, you have a moment of peace. A moment of peace. But then comes in all the rajas again, worried about how to protect the object. And so we say that the desire itself is agitation. It creates a lot of agitation. So it's very rajasic. So you see both ways that it can be used. So in this previous verse, in 37, he says this kama, this krodha, this is born of rajas, or it gives birth to rajas. So you see how both ways can be? Okay. Then he says, and this kama krodha, it is the mahashana, it is gluttonous. It's gluttonous because you can never give it, you can never feed it enough. It's never satisfied. So it's a pig, okay? Mahashana. And it's mahapapma. It is also a great, it causes so much papa. It causes great papa because the other side of kama is krodha. Right? And with kama and both of them, kama and krodha, as we'll see in this next verse now, they cover the buddhi. They cover your wisdom. They cover your viveka. They cover your judgment. And because they cover the judgment, you know, about the what we call what is to be done, with the karya akarya karmas. The karya karmas are those things that are to be done. What is dharma in a given situation? If the kama is not there, then what is to be done? I'm clear to make that judgment. What is the appropriate action in a given situation? That's what I'll naturally do if I'm not blinded by the kama. But if the kama is there, the kama can actually overwhelm my judgment. That's the problem. And in overwhelming the judgment, then I can do the akarya, those things that are not to be done. And of course, krodha can cause any amount of problems. Your anger causes, you know, if you can't hold that anger, it causes so much violence. It causes violence to yourself. And without, with the loss of dhamma, it, you know, the loss of being able to hold it, it causes violence to others. Then you should think of krodha first of all as causing violence to yourself. Right? Because krodha, anger, is very, very upsetting. When you're feeling angry, you are in pain. Right? You're feeling, or the anger puts you in emotional pain and physical pain, and you feel isolated. And you feel like striking out. So you yourself are being hurt by the krodha. And then if the krodha acts out, if you act it out, then the other person is being hurt. So what causes the krodha? Kama. So he says, this kama, this krodha, is the Mahapatma. It's a great sinner. Means it causes you to do adharma. It causes you to cause pain. That's why when we think of this sin and adharma, you should think punya and papa. If you say something is papa, what does it mean? It means it causes pain for yourself and for others. It causes painful situations. It's a very simple way to understand it. You know? And so, so he says, may you know viddhi. May you know anam vairinam. May you know this is the great enemy. This is the great enemy. And now he goes into this next verse and he says, why is it a great enemy? He says, Dumena avriyate vanihi yata. Yata means just as. Just as fire is covered by smoke, right? Dumena means by smoke. Avriyate is covered. Vanihi, nam at the singular. Yata. Just as fire, avriyate is covered, dumena, by smoke. Yata adarshaha malena cha. And just as a mirror, adarshaha is a mirror, just as a mirror is covered by mala, like dust or dirt, okay? So just as a fire is covered by smoke, and just as a mirror is covered by dirt, yata urbena avritaha garbaha, just as a fetus is covered by the womb, urbena, just as the fetus is covered by the womb, tata, similarly, tena idam avritam. Tena, by this karma, idam, this jnanam, idam goes back to jnanam, this jnanam is covered. Right? The jnanam here can mean the buddhi, or your knowledge. So, he used three examples, which, you know, this is a very famous verse, right? Yes. Because it kind of makes you understand how karma actually works. You have a certain wisdom. One wisdom is this. It's the karya akarya karma. You know what is to be done. You have that viveka about what is to be done, what is dharma, what is adharma. You have that clarity. You also have atma anatma viveka. These two things. You know yourself, you know what is not the self. For mumukshu, somebody who studied. You know dharma, adharma, and you know so atma, anatma, viveka. You have that discrimination. But the kama covers this. It covers this buddhi. It covers the buddhi that the buddhi that knows what to do, what not to do. It covers the buddhi that has knowledge. Okay? How does it cover it? Well, sometimes it covers it like a fire can be covered by its own smoke. Now, in this example, think of it like this. The fire itself is bright and self-luminous. Right? But the smoke that it's generating can cause it to be covered. You don't see the fire, you just see the smoke. But to remove that smoke, you can basically just swish it away. It's not really a big deal. You can swish the smoke away. You know, it doesn't take much. Swamiji in his little basha on this, he uses the example of, say for instance, you go into a store, supermarket, and you see some things that you would like. Lots of them. And then you say, no, I don't really need those. You don't have enough money for them. You just let it go and you leave. That's the smoke. Nothing had really had time to get lodged. Right? You were just simply going into the supermarket. You were going maybe to pick up some groceries. You didn't have any big desires for anything. And now you're walking along the aisles and you see this and that. And, oh, that'd be nice to have. But your mind then says, well, I don't think I really need that, do I? No, you don't. Okay, let's move on. Very simple. That could have a lot of desires like that, which they've not lodged in your mind. There's not something that you've worked them over, right? It's building up a big desire for something. They're just the day-to-day desires that come that you can flick off. No problem. They don't compete with what is good for you. See, if they don't really compete, what is good for you, what your buddhi knows to be the right thing to do, is so much stronger than these that you can brush them away. So those are just little commas, no problem. But then there are other commas, you know, which are more like, it doesn't brush away that easily. Like, for instance, they use an example of a mirror that's covered with dirt. Think of it as covered with dirt, not covered with dust. If it's covered with dust, you could just go, and it's gone. But if it's covered with dirt, then you have to really clean it. You have to get out a rag and really wipe this thing down. And so that takes more effort, right? That desire, that type of desire takes more effort. Now, the thing is, even with this one, as they get a little bit harder, the thing is always to remember is that really, there's nothing wrong necessarily with a desire. I mean, we live because of desire. That's what makes us do what we do. The problem is whether or not that desire is good for you. That's what it amounts to. Does the particular desire bless me and others, or is it something that is going to be problematic for me? That's the problem. Do I have a control? So that's number one. Is it karya or akarya? Is that desire, does that desire get in the way of what is good for me or for others? I can't lose my buddhi around that. The desire, what that means is that when the desire comes up, if my buddhi is able to control that desire, if the buddhi has the freedom to say yes or no, there's no problem. What if the buddhi doesn't have the freedom to say yes or no? The kama grabs me, grabs my buddhi, and like a wild horse, you know, is just dragging it along with it. Really. Then that's the problem, because there's nobody strong enough there to make the judgment, to make a judgment on that. It is the same in terms of atma and atma viveka, in terms of my own shanti. Does the desire take away my peace? Does it take away my peace? Am I able to pursue that desire either with a karma yoga buddhi? You know, karma yoga buddhi means I want to do this, but I'm able to take the results as prasadam. So this is, remember, we've already done the karya kadana. That's important. If you can't do the karya kadana, it means this is to be done, this is not to be done. And my value in terms of what is to be done and what is not to be done is stronger than the desire. If it's stronger than the desire, then if the desire is problematic, I can say no. Very simply, I can say no. If it's not stronger, then even the adharma, I will go for. And the adharma is always like sticking your hand in fire. You've gone against what is appropriate behavior, what is right behavior. And if you go against that, then your mind is going to be very upset. It's like Swamiji always says, you know, in the whole Shastra, this dharma, this kaushalam of understanding dharma, adharma, and always choosing the dharma, is a primary sadhana. Because if you don't, the mind gets very, very upset. A dharma that, I don't know what's more agitating than a dharma, you know. It's agitating by law. Just like sticking your hand in fire is agitating by law. You know, you can pull your hand out and fix it up again, but you've been burned. And adharma is that way too. Every time we do an unkind act, an uncharitable act, a selfish act, all of these types of things, or behave irresponsibly, in a situation, it will come back. It just comes back right at your face. And that's how we learn. You know, I think that's why people say, how many people say all over the world that, you know, life is your greatest teacher? Right? That's why sometimes we say every single situation that we're in is a teaching, a test. That so many things like this are always said. Because it's true. We always have to, again and again and again, we are taught how to be in a situation in such a way that it doesn't cause us pain. And it all has to do with Dharma. It doesn't have to do with fulfilling desire. Fulfilling desire is so far down the line of peace and pleasure. It's amazing. You can't have pleasure at the expense of Dharma, because the universe doesn't allow it. And so it creates so much strife inside when that's happening. So that becomes a great teacher. So now here, if you think of the mirror, the dirty mirror, that's a stronger desire. That's one where you have to come in. You don't just brush it off as you're walking along. You have to say no. This one you have to say, no, this is not good for you. You're not going to do it. And the karma says, yes, I am. And you say,
it's a tug of war.
You say, no, this is not good for you. I'm not going to let you do this. Yes, I am. No, you're not.
Oh, yes, I am.
And so there's work there. But at this point, you know that this is not something that you want to do, and you have to discipline yourself not to. A good example is food. Swami Jesus, the example of,
chocolate.
Overeating, eating too much, you know, where you have to say, because the food is good, and you have to say, no, you can't have any more. Why? I want just a little more. No, because it's not good for you. And then you take some more anyway. And then next time you remember that was not a pleasant experience. and you learn. You have to work at it. Right? Because you know it's not good for you. So you work at it. The next one is even much stronger. In a fetus in a womb is going to take place in its own time. Some things, you know, this is where we're talking about those much bigger desires that are much deeper, where you feel it's not like saying no to food or no, I'm not going to go to the movie again or whatever. These things are easy. But there's bigger desires that require a lot of maturity, you know, to be able to and a lot of maturity, a lot of viveka, a lot of jnanam, a lot of knowledge to be able to accept the life that you have. Right? It's really accepting the life that you have. And in a way that you recognize, I don't need what I don't have. I don't need what I don't have. There's a dhamma, shama and dhamma there, you know, where I can accept the life that I have. I can accept the situation that's really karma yoga. I can accept the situation that I find myself in. I can accept the people that are important in my life. And so it becomes much more deeper. This is something that takes place. It's a growth that takes place over time that is as much to do with my own nishta. Do you see what I'm saying? There's a nishta, jnana nishta, that has to take place that... Let me see, how's one thing that's been very, very important for me in this is this understanding in terms of these bigger desires is that this life that you have is an expression of your karma. Right? And your karma, the prarabdha karma that caused you to take this birth, is giving you this life. And what is true to your karma will be yours. You don't have to worry about it. You know, nobody's stronger than Bhagawan. And so Bhagawan gave you this life with this karma that will take you from your birth to your death. And the things that are meant to happen for you in this life will happen. They are yours. Nobody can take them away. They're here. For better or for worse. Right? It's like a lifelong marriage. For better or for worse. This is your life. This is your karma. This is Bhagawan. You're married to Bhagawan. And this is what Bhagawan is giving you. For better or worse. Sometimes it's not so good. Sometimes it's great. Whatever. This is it. And it is yours. What is not yours, you're not going to get. What's not in your karma, somebody else's karma, they will get it, you won't. And now if you're mad at them for getting it because you didn't, right? It's a good, when you get mad at somebody for getting it or think they're going to take away from you, or take away from you what is yours, then you can remember this. Oh, this is my karma. And nobody can take it away from me. And nobody can take that person's karma away from them either. Yeah. And that understanding, you know, it really clears out a lot of things. It's a vivek, it's bringing in some knowledge, you know, that stops you from lusting after two things. It's like lusting after what somebody else has or might have and worrying about what you have and somebody else might take away. See what I mean? Like sometimes we think that somebody will take away our opportunities for us, from us. And they won't. Unless you were never going to have that opportunity. They're not going to take it away if it's in your karma. If it's not in your karma, you're not going to get it. See? So that's looking at the life in terms of just the main unfoldment of your life. There's certain things that will take you all the way through from birth to death. The basic stream of your life. And within the basic stream of your life, you are given all that you need. And so say if you can have that attitude, especially when that's being challenged because of your own karma. And the karma, of course, brings about krodha. It also brings about bhaya, fear. You know, that something that I need is going to be taken away from me, or something that I need, I'm not going to be given, all of these type of things. If you bring that understanding of the prarabdha karma back into mind, you can then at least relax and say, even if you're not convinced it's true, you can say, okay, let me see if it's true. Let me see how my life unfolds and see if my life brings to me what I actually need. It's very interesting, because the more you bring that to consciousness, the more you see, I do have everything I need for my life. And that type of growth is like giving birth to a baby. It's painful. I'm kidding. But what I mean is, it takes place over time, you know, and it has to do with much bigger issues, you know, than eating more food or, you know, having a desire in the supermarket. It's dealing with much bigger issues that have to do with you, with your very being, with your very life, with the trajectory of your life, with your own feelings of accomplishment and feelings of importance or meaningfulness. There's just so many issues that have to do with you as being a human being on this planet and having a meaningful life. So that can get the meaningfulness of your life can get clouded by comments that are born from seeing another person's life, you know, or seeing the threats to your own happiness surrounding you, you know, the people and situations that you think can take away your happiness. And so that requires a lot more, a lot different kind of maturity. So he says, this knowledge, looking at this twofold viveka, dharma adharma, karya akarya, okay, this twofold viveka, and then also atma anatma. So one has more to do with that kaushan, that karma yoga buddhi. Atma anatma is remembering what is the source of your ananda. All of this talk, it's helpful. It's helpful because living a dharmic life just gives you so much more peace, relative peace, than an adharmic life. Understanding prarabdha karma, that's very helpful because it helps you to relax into your own life, which gives you shanti. But what about the fact that the ananda that you seek is yourself? That what you are seeking for, you already have. That has to do not only with your sense of wholeness, your sense of fullness or happiness, it also has to do with your sense of well-being, your sense of meaning. Like, for instance, ananda is a very big word. When we are with ourselves, just recognizing my own presence, who I am. This presence, the very swarupa, the very nature of my being, is meaningfulness, is purposefulness. And what I mean is, if I say to you, you know, you feel happy, say, oh yeah, I feel happy. You feel whole sometimes, you can say, yes, I feel whole. But you know what? You also feel purposeful. You also feel like your life is meaningful. Right? Those feelings cut sometimes more, sometimes less. Are you feeling life has meaning? When you say, oh, life has meaning, things have, you've made connections just in the world, the way things are going, maybe you've seen synchronous events, maybe you see things are happening your way in a way that makes you feel at peace. But what you say is life has meaning. When you say that, you are referring to a feeling of meaningfulness. It's like if I say, I feel happy, I feel whole, I feel like life is meaningful. There's actually a feeling there. Because you can have the sense that feeling is ananda. That's what I'm saying. All of these words, life is meaningful, life is purposeful, life is whole, life is complete, life is ananda, I am ananda. All of these things are all pointing to an experiential wholeness of your being, and that isn't being clouded. I don't know if I'm making sense here, but you can think about it when you're reflecting, or the next time you feel your own presence in terms of meaningfulness, just make that connection. When you feel like you have purpose or meaning in your life, when you feel that way, it doesn't really have anything to do with anything out here. It has to do with a state of mind. You can feel that way no matter what is going on. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't have anything to do with what's going on. It has to do with your own swarupa, with your own nature. And so these things that make life purposeful, make life meaningful, make life successful. This is another thing. I feel successful. Successful is a feeling. Meaningful, feeling. Purposeful, feeling. It has nothing to do with the world. These are words that are labeling your own being. Well, just like the word ananda, or wholeness, is labeling your own being, even though you superimpose it on the world. It has nothing to do with the world. And so what that means is that you could be absolutely anything, anywhere, at any time, in any situation, and feel life is meaningful and purposeful, you know, and I am whole and complete. Because those feelings belong to the Atma. They don't belong to the world. See what I'm saying? And so if your mind, the problem is that your mind superimposes all of this onto the creation, you know, and when things are going your way and your mind, your way in a particular, things are going your way in a particular way, so that your mind is quiet in a particular way, then you say, oh, life is so meaningful. But you look next time, the sense of meaningfulness is the ananda swarupa of your own being. That's all it is. And your mind, because of its certain way of being quiet, is labeling yourself in that way. You can also have exactly the same situation and feel exactly the same situation, but your attitude isn't quite the same. And in the same situation, you'll say, life is meaningless. There is no purpose to this life. There is nothing, no rhyme and reason to this life. It doesn't make any sense. It's completely meaningless. You see? It's true. So this has to be straightened out. Because in the end, with your jnana nishtha, the meaningfulness of life is the self. This whole creation is Ishvara. This is Ishvara is the meaningfulness. The Atma, that you know, the self that manifests as Ishvara, this is the meaningfulness. That's why Swamiji once a couple of years ago, they wanted him to give a lecture on New Year's Day. What is the purpose of life? What is the purpose of life? Just want to do that. What is the purpose of life? He said, the purpose of life is to live it. The purpose of life is to live it, because the purpose of life is just life itself, is Ishvara. There is no other purpose. What is the purpose? You can say from within the creation, the purpose of life is to get liberated. You can say that. You know, but really, the purpose of life, the meaningfulness of life, is that it is. The self is beginningless. The self has no purpose because it is. It hasn't become anything. So what purpose is there for something that has no beginning, is free from time, is absolutely timeless? It's not about purpose. It's what is. And so the idea of purpose and meaningfulness is just simply a words that express the nature of the very swarupa of the self. The very nature of the self is meaningfulness, is purposefulness, is ananda in its own timelessness. And that swarupa of the self expresses as infinite knowledge in the form of this creation. And so then this creation, what is it? It's an expression of the very swarupa of the self, right? And what is that swarupa? Well, it is meaningfulness, ananda, wholeness. In ananta, you know, ananta means limitlessness. That limitlessness is expressed in this creation. So what happens when your mind is not overwhelmed by kama and krodha? Is that this upadhi is not in the way. There's nothing in the way. There's no competing emotions or agitations that are in the way of that swarupa of yourself filling up your mind. Right? So the mind is like a clear, the swarupa of yourself is always there, but now the mind is always there, experientially there is me. But now the mind becomes sattvic, right? So it is not creating any problems for you. It's not creating the pain. There's no tamas there. It's not creating hurtful experiences, which yourself is illumining. So yourself is always there. The me is always there. But what is being illumined in the mind are hurtful, painful experiences because of adharma or because of karma, because of krodha. But what about when those things aren't there? Then the mind just like a clean mirror, a fire without smoke, where the child has been born. It's just simply present without any obstruction, without any competing emotions. And so what is the experience there for jnani or ajnani is life is wonderful. All is fine with me. This is so beautiful. It is so profound. It is so meaningful. Bhagawan is so present. That's the experience. Bhagawan is so present. This is the mind talking, right? Because of the sattva, the kama and krodha are not there. For the jnani, the jnani enjoys much more than an ajnani, that sattvic mind. Because of knowledge, right? Because you know that the source of the ananda, the meaningfulness, the wholeness that you seek is your very being. And that gives so much strength to the buddhi. Because the buddhi knows the illusion of this running after this kama and krodha. It knows that illusion. When it knows the illusion, it can pull it back. You know, it can say, no, you don't. You really don't need that. It's not good for you. It doesn't make you happy anyway. Forget it. But you can pull it back because of your knowledge. You know, the mumukshu or the one who's gaining knowledge. You know what the source of ananda or wholeness is. You know that in truth, you don't need anything like that, and you have what you don't need anything other than what you have. And that you are the source of the ananda. And your mind is just habitually going after this or going after that. So you know that. So knowing with that knowledge, you can pull your mind back. You know, from things, desires, and situations, ways of behavior that are harmful to you. If you don't have that knowledge, it's harder. You have to rely on, when you don't have self-knowledge, you have to rely on dharma. Your knowledge of dharma, adharma. And in the world, we gain knowledge of dharma, adharma. We know that from experience that adharma causes so much pain, dharma gives me relative shanti. And so then I have to rely on dharma, even though I want something very badly. The ajnani, relying on dharma, even though I want something very badly, it takes a lot of strength and a lot of, you know, it's not so when I want something, it's not when I don't want that much, but when I want something really badly, that dharma can become overwhelmed by the desire. For jnani, it's much, much easier. For mumukshu, somebody who's gaining knowledge, because it's not just dharma that's holding your mind in check. It's your knowledge that the source of the ananda you seek has nothing to do with the world. Zero. The source of the ananda is only your being. It's only Brahman. That's it. Nothing else. The only thing that allows you to enjoy that ananda, from the standpoint of the mind has an experience of well-being and non-agitation. The only thing that allows that is for the mind to relax. You think that a desire has something to do with it? Only because a fulfilled desire allows the mind to relax for a minute, because it's desireless for a minute. That's the only thing these commas have to do with it. They allow that, they trick you. It's an illusion, right? You think that my happiness is in the object. You run after the object, ever with much suffering often, thinking that until I get this, I'll never be happy if I don't get this. Okay? My life will be ruined if I don't to feel this, and so and so is getting in my way, and this and that. We build up a whole samsara, right? And then you finally, if you're lucky, you finally fulfill your desire, and for that moment, I am happy. I'm ecstatic because I had been single-pointedly so, you know, obsessed on this object. When I finally get it, for that moment, my mind is desireless. It's relaxed. That's all it is. That's why I'm happy, because my mind is relaxed. It has nothing to do with the object. And so say, the more I understand this, the more value I have, the mind, the more value the mind gains for just being with myself, enjoying firsthand the ananda of my being, and from that sthanam, from that place, experiencing my prarabdha. It's so simple, because if I am with myself, right, with myself, experiencing my prarabdha, then I have the happiness and the wholeness and the security that a person needs from where it is, from its source. And the mind is never away from that source. And so sitting there in that source of myself, I am interested in the prarabdha that Ishvara, this is my little section of Ishvara, right? Because this is what I experience as a jiva. And so I see this as my prarabdha. And then I live out this prarabdha as opposed to somebody else's. And I can live out and be totally one with my prarabdha if I know that this life and everybody's life has nothing to do with the ananda. The only thing that has to do with the ananda is my own being. When that's the case, then I can enjoy Ishvara. And life becomes very, very simple. But that is like a child being born. That understanding doesn't just come, you know, overnight. That involves time and viveka and exposure to knowledge and just maturing in the wisdom of my knowledge. So. Okay, why don't we stop here? Stop there.
I find it interesting that I think you mentioned it tonight, fear, bias, that isn't more prominent in the desire anger equation.
In some it is, yeah. I mean, in some, when we talk about it, some bit karma and krodha come together often, but you know, in the Taittiriya Upanishad, Baya is given a lot of prominence, where it says, even if there's even a whiff, just a whiff of duality, there's baya, fear. So baya comes up a lot in this teaching. But you're right, in the kama, they usually just say avidya, kama, krodha. Avidya means ignorance. Avidya, kama, krodha. This little trinity is responsible for it so much. But bias is almost bigger than that.
Bias covers more artha, huh? It seems like artha and bias tend to belong together.
Yeah, art degree. Yeah. But yeah, that's true. Well, that is true. Because really, how can you be secure in duality? You know? There is nothing secure. You can't count on everything. Everything's finite, subject to death, subject to change. And that's why they say that. You know, even the slightest whiff, of course, if there's the slightest whiff of duality, immediately there's duality. There's no such thing as the slightest whiff of duality. Mm-hmm. It's either there or not. But the instant duality enters the picture, there's bhaya. Yeah. You can even think of that in terms of having that sattvic mind, that sattva buddhi, you know, where you haven't divided the world up. It's really just Ishvara. Yeah. But the instant the karma comes, then the world divides up and there's fear. Instant. Because you may not get that what you want. You may not be able to keep it once you do get it. Yeah. But you can see, you know, also, say if you understand this karma and krodha and bhaya you can bring in. If there's a karma is there, duality has to come, okay? Duality comes, there'll be karma, there'll be krodha, of course there'll be bhaya. But you see how all of these emotions themselves are generated by this ignorance, by the avidya that causes the karma. So the emotions themselves that you experience, like hatred and anger, you know, rage, all of these painful emotions, jealousy, envy, all of these things that cause so much pain, all of these are generated by ajnana, really, by karma. That's why we say karma, desire, comes out of the avidya. But what we will say, as long as you have a body and you have karma, you will have karma, because that's part of the karma. It's part of the power of the karma. But how does this karma affect you? Does it take away your buddhi? You know, do you believe it to be true? You know, the full template. I want this. That's the karma. I want this so that I can be happy. That's the ajnana. I want this so that I can be happy. And you're not kidding either. That whole template is there. For ajnani, it's, I want this. But this part, so that I can be happy, isn't there. And because that isn't there, because I already am happy, I already am whole, I want this, that's all. Why do you want it? Well, I want it. I have a desire for it. And I'll enjoy that. But there's not hooked up with my well-being. And when that's the case, it doesn't have the power to generate, you know, it's what we call a dugdha bija, burnt seeds. It can generate some, karma can still generate some krodha and some bhaya and all of these things, but all of them are dugdha bija, burnt seeds, in the sense that they don't mean very much to you. They're like smoke. You can blow it away. All of those, that's a good way to look at it. All of those things are like smoke. You can whisk it away. You know, because you know yourself. And so they don't have a hold on you like that. You can say no, you can whisk it away. You can say no, don't do that, that's not good for you. You know, bring your mind back, because you have a self.
So is that why the Jnani can have preferences?
Yeah, you will have preferences. Because of your very prakriti, the very all of your past lives, this life, all of the things, all of the likes and dislikes that make up lifetimes and have brought you to this life, so you'll have lots of preferences. But the, you know, I'd rather do this than that. That's how we live. That's what makes us unique. But those, satisfying those preferences, if you have a choice and it's dharmic and it's appropriate, you'll satisfy the preference. But if you don't, that's fine too. That's the difference. I'll go for the preferences, but if I don't get it, then that's fine. You know, really, I mean, it's like the balloon going up in the air. I go for what is natural for me, and even there, because of your prakriti, your just all of the karmas that brought you to where you are now, That Prakriti will give you the set of desires and likes and dislikes that you have. You can't just decide, oh, I think I'll have a new set of likes and dislikes. You can't do that. You have the likes and dislikes and the preferences that you have. And those are the ones that are going to be, that's what's going to be coming up in your mind, not somebody else's likes and dislikes. Right? And so you don't really have a choice over the likes and dislikes that are coming. I mean, you can mold them as time goes on, but you, what comes, comes. You have a choice on how you handle them. It may be a life or a preference that, based upon your knowledge and understanding now, you don't feel is appropriate for you. And so you can say no to that like or dislike. Right? You have that free will to be able to say no to it. But you can't say to your psyche, this life, please don't come again. This preference, I don't think you should, you should let that, you shouldn't come again. You shouldn't come into my mind again. It's not going to happen. Yeah. It's like the story about, you know, don't think of a tomato. When you start to meditate in the morning, just follow these instructions clearly. When you sit down to meditate, make sure you don't think of the tomato.
You know, with this like a swift of duality, it's not just higher that comes in, it's also, and it's not just the negative emotions, it's also the positive emotions, right? It's also generosity, you know, feeling love towards other people.
Yeah, but you know what? Those are the natural human feelings that are unobstructed. You know, say for Jnani, for instance, when the kama and krodha are not there, these are the natural feelings, love, and this is what it means to be human, unobstructed human. An unobstructed human being is generous and kind and enjoys the wonder of the creation, helpful, all of these things. This is what makes a human, this is what a human being is. These other things are the thwarted. You know, when your desires are being thwarted, these negative things come. Otherwise, it's joy and happiness. What stops the joy and happiness? When you don't want anything.
So it's the lack of viveka, of buddhi, that is not applied to the manas that generates these obstructed emotions?
Well, that's in the next verse, they're going to deal with that. But look at your buddhi as being the one that has knowledge and clarity. Dharma, adharma, and also Atma and Atma Viveka. The buddhi has this. Okay. That buddhi can say no to the kama, to the desires that come. Because adharmic, not good for you, all of these reasons, it has its reasons to say no. If the kama is too big, then that kama can overwhelm the buddhi and just take it along for a ride where you lose your Dhamma. And so now in these next verses, Krishna will say, hey Arjuna, you have to nip these kamas in the bud. Don't let them grow. Don't let them grow. When one comes, you make a judgment whether this is good for me or not, and nip it in the bud before your mind starts fantasizing on it. No, and building up power. So he'll discuss that.
So you're basically summarizing all obstructed emotions in karma.
You can, that's right. Because what causes all of these negative feelings? Obstructed karma. Mm-hmm. Not obstructed karma creates so many different emotions. Krishna was saying Shankara Kamata. You know, this karma before a jnani or mumukshu, before a jnani, the karma itself is always viewed in a sense as an enemy, is the language they're using. It's always viewed as an enemy because from its very rise it obstructs, it takes away your peace. As soon as it rises, it takes away your peace. It's because all of a sudden now you need something to be different, when you don't really need anything to be different.
But you know, sometimes that desire doesn't come just from the inside. Sometimes you're attacked. Some force comes from the outside to disturb you. I mean, you know.
Like what?
Well, being attacked. I've been attacked before.
No, but we're talking about karma.
Yeah, but I mean, to get to be upset, to want things different. I mean, being attacked from the outside by others.
No, wait a minute. That's true. You have to remember this template.
Mm-hmm.
I want this so that I can be happy, right? So, if your mind already is happy, then you want this. It's going to be like, say somebody's physically attacking you.
Yeah.
You're immediately going to act to protect yourself, because that's just part of being human. Right?
Yeah.
You're not going to stand there and say, I'm a jnani, so beat me.
You put your fist together. And
yeah, right. You're going to respond to the situation. Objectively respond to the situation. Right? And if somebody's attacking you, you're going to respond quickly to protect yourself. Otherwise, that wouldn't be natural. You would just say, I'm a great jnani, so hit me over the head. It's not going to happen like that.
And the karma also means just, I mean, we talk of it in terms of negative desire, but there's also karma to say, I want to change the world for the better, I want to do good in the world, I want to be generous. There's good.
Yeah, and that can be really make you into a very sick person. If you say like this, I want to do good for the world, and I won't be happy unless the world becomes good.
Right.
Right? But if I say, I want to do good for the world, I want to help others, that's dharma. That's what is a natural human being. You know, but then if you say, I want to do good, or I won't be happy, or, you see what I mean? Even if you say, I want to be good, and not doing good for the world makes me unhappy, that's all right too, because that's natural to want to do good. But what if you say, I want to do good for the world, I want to do something to make the world good? If you do like that and the world doesn't become good, or what if the world isn't becoming as good as you want them to become, you know? Or what if your partner or your child or your family are not becoming as happy as you want them to become? All of these things are a problem. If you want them to be happy and do what you can to make them happy.
And you gave up so much.
Right. That also becomes a problem. But if you just, you want them to be happy like you want all beings to be happy, and you do your very best, and at the same time allow them to be what they are, then you're free. Right?
In here, it almost doesn't seem like it's possible to be truly dharmic without having knowledge.
No, it's too hard.
Because
you have to go against your nature.
Yeah.
When you think that your ananda is out here, you know, your dharma can only go so far often. But it becomes stronger and stronger and stronger the more you realize that the dharma actually contributes more to your well-being than the satisfying the desire. So again, it's all going to come down to knowledge. Right? But to go all the way, really, you have with it, you have to know yourself. You have to know the locus of happiness so that you're not threatened. And really, you're not threatened at all. but it takes a tremendous amount of maturity and reflection, you know. Manana. Shravana manana nididhyasana over time for the mind to really be able to own that up fully. It takes time. We'll never run out of time. There's no time. That's a neat thing. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that, because Arjuna was so worried about that, he's going in the battle, he could be killed any time.
Well,
could forget right. Everything, you know, during the war. Krishna said, don't worry, even if you get killed in the battle, you'll be reborn to a household of yogis. Where you can be immediately reunited with your knowledge. Or you'll be born in a very dharmic house. If you have some things to take care of, some desires that need to be fulfilled, you'll be born in a house of dharmas. And then fulfill some of your desires that need to be taken care of. And then you'll be reunited with your knowledge.
Well, does that apply to us too?
Yeah, if you get knocked off before... before your mind is settled,
yeah.
Then you'll just get reborn and have a nice, wonderful set of parents that love you.
Can you sign that here?
Well, that's what Krishna said. That's what Krishna said. I think that that's true, because that makes sense to me. That's how it would be.
Confusion.
But what's a better way that it could be? It seems like that's just the what would naturally happen. We're all reunited with our knowledge. There are some scars, like when they say, when you take to this knowledge, it's called, you have, sometimes somebody say, well, he or she has, you know, some scars, Vedanta some scars, Advaita some scars. You know, picking up where you left off, you didn't complete it last time, or, you know.
So
like, look at Mira.
Audience, huh?
She must be born into a house of yogis, you know?
Well,
awesome little girl.
Yogis.
Yeah, no, but people who are seekers.
Yeah.
Who are, you know? Just imagine the karma of a little baby being born into, that's being born into the house of yogis, you know.
Mm.
Pick up her knowledge, she didn't complete it last time, so Bhagavan said, okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty phenomenal.
Phenomenal, phenomenal karma.
Maybe next time I'll be born into your family.
She will have to come around again.
You and Kiki's Arjun, you know? When we were at the, he's such a sweet boy. When we were at the ashram in Coimbatore, he would ride with Swamiji and walk with him, and just so at home. So at home. Love to be with him. When it was time to go, he was kind of crying and said he didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Very, very sweet. The special children that are born into the home of people who are spiritually have knowledge. It's an amazing, amazing karma.
So what about the Adrishta?
Adrishta Punya? Adrishta is Punya and Papa.
Well, not just Adrishta Punya, but Adrishta in general. It's just the unseen, you know. It's just
oh.
just like, I mean, it's kind of like dream time to begin with in a certain way, what we're living here, you know. So
when you start seeing everything as Ishvara, then everything is wondrous, because you see infinite intelligence, and it becomes more of a matter of trying to kind of understand the creation, understand the balance, understand the order. Because say if you see this whole thing as an infinite order, that's a word Swamiji uses a lot, the infinite order of the creation as being Ishvara, then our minds are limited, right? Just get limited. Limited experience, limited intelligence. But then limited intelligence is experiencing infinite intelligence. So you think the infinite order of everything, and then try to look at the, enjoy kind of looking at the creation in terms of that infinite order to understand it. You don't look at it as just an inert, man-made mess. But look at it as part of the infinite order and see how the laws are balancing out. It's really interesting.
Did you just say, limitless consciousness experiencing infinite?
This is limited, right? This is limited experiencing limitless order, the limitless order of Ishvara. So many things, you know, you just see things balancing out and how things affect each other. It's all laws.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I mean, I love that. And you realize the jiva is part of an infinite intelligence, infinite manifest knowledge. You know. So to just say if you have that drishti, that kind of vision, then if you're looking at the creation through that overlay of an infinite order of Ishvara, then you try to appreciate what's going on in the creation. It's not just an inert Mother Nature.
And when you say limitless, the limited body-mind complex, experiencing the unlimitedness.
The limitless creation. In other words, If you look at the creation as an infinite expression of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
your body is part of that, held within that. And so the sphere of the world that you experience is a sphere, is part of that infinite
mm-hmm.
expression of knowledge.
Yeah, I was just for a moment, I was just thinking, why is this body-mind complex even limited, you know, if it feels like it's also not, right?
Yeah, only limited when you're looking at it as a part to the whole.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so
that way.
So that was the reference point. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
I think we should stop now.